Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for February 6, 2003. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. I've got two segments lined up for tonight. First, we'll speak with Ellen Frank, professor of economics at Emmanuel College in Boston, and also a member of the editorial collective at Dollars and Cents magazine, about the Bush budget and the deficit outlook and all these kinds of things. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Lenny Brenner, the author and editor of a new collection of books, a collection of 51 documents, which is the title, 51 documents, documenting Zionist collaboration with the Nazis. And as the jacket says, contains explosive information historians ignore. And it's just published by Barricade Books. And that will be at about 5:30. And we'll get to Ellen Frank in just a moment, but I want to say a couple of things. First of all, about the U.S. economy, which is stumbling along. And this morning it was announced that productivity, which is supposedly one of the great bright spots in the economy, has gone into reverse, with the productivity, that is the output for hour of work for the average worker, actually declining in the fourth quarter of last year. And that is, of course, a reversal of the alleged productivity acceleration that we saw in the second half of the 1990s. Whether this is the beginning of a trend, I don't know, but it is interesting that it seems to have, at least for the moment, ground to a halt. And I'm just finishing up my book, After the New Economy, which will go into this matter in great depth, and I will, of course, bore you with all the details as its publication date gets closer. Tomorrow morning, the Bureau of Labor Statistics will announce, will release the monthly employment report, the source of the number of jobs created or lost in the economy, and also the unemployment rate and related statistics like that. And it's going to be a very, very difficult report to read for a whole bunch of technical reasons, which are really just a little complicated and boring for radio, so I will spare you those, but it may not be a very revealing report. It may actually obscure more than it reveals just because of all these technical complications, but I suspect that the underlying trend of the U.S. economy is still struggling along flat, not going anywhere, not collapsing, but certainly not recovering either. And very much like it was 10 years ago when Daddy Bush was in office in a lot of ways. And in another matter, the manager of the world's largest bond portfolio, Bill Gross, who runs the bond department of Pacific Investment Management Corporation, PIMCO, put up a commentary on PIMCO's website. That's PIMCO.com, if you want to go take a look for it. His February Investment Outlook commentary about the decline of U.S. hegemony. Actually, the title is Hegemonic Decay, which is really something you don't read in Wall Street commentaries very often. Hegemony, as Gross helpfully defines it, is the dominance of one country over others, not only militarily, but economically as well, and as fitting a word as you can imagine to describe the world's current state of affairs. There is little doubt that we have an American hegemony. And then Gross goes on to say, but while the United States rules the waves as well as turf and sky, I'm not sure that we are or perhaps will be the economic powerhouse we once were. 3 years of stock market declines, a 20% devaluation of the dollar over 10 months, and an inability to serve as the global economy's locomotive despite massive monetary and fiscal stimulation suggests America's shining city on a hill may have lost some of its sheen of late. The U.S. of A. seems is becoming less wealthy by the minute as foreign investment is withheld and in some cases redirected towards Chinese and other more attractive ports of call. Economically, we may have begun a process of hegemonic decay. The initiation of U.S. hegemonic decline, I'm continuing to read from Gross, this isn't me, can't be blamed on any single source. Excessive buildup of private debt, which in part led to an investment in stock market bubble, has been the primary culprit. Our overvalued dollar and near-historic trade deficit are in the running for the hegemonic Oscar as well. And also, he continues to say that the endless war against terrorism, whatever that is exactly, is going to be a a great economic burden on the United States, and it is going to involve, as he puts it, potential policy reversals that have formed the backbone of America's economic hegemony for nearly seven decades. Hegemony has been based on America's military domination, and America's superior economy is reflected by the dollar's ascension to the top of the pile as the world's reserve currency. All hegemonies, including Britannia's, have shared similar characteristics. As the leader of the pack, America has been able to implement policies, free trade, open capital markets, and a strong currency, which have not only reflected its political heritage and philosophy, but have added dollars and cents to its citizens' pocketbooks, as well as SUVs to their driveways. But the U.S., unlike the British Empire, rests on a fragile foundation built on consumer spending and trade deficits, as opposed to mercantilism and trade surpluses, which characterized Britannia's rule. These deficits, coming at a time of American military expansion in pursuit of terrorist containment, threaten to reverse our hegemonic benefits and end our economic domination. Our SUVs, as well as our Top Cat near monopoly of the good times, are at risk. And then he goes on to say, end to the strong dollar is but the most visible reversal of U.S. hegemonic policies in recent months. Our promotion of free trade and open capital markets is suffering as well. And he says, while this may not all qualify as a trip to the poorhouse, I have no doubt that such events signify to at least some Americans a trip to a poorer house. Many of us will have to adjust, either in the form of higher unemployment, an increased price for imported goods, or heavier indirect taxes in the form of higher inflation and interest rates. And like I say, the analysis is not all that remarkable for people who've been familiar with reading the radical press over the years, but for the world's most important bond manager to be saying these things, it's pretty amazing. So the end of American hegemony is a theme that's finally hitting Wall Street. And now we're joined on the line by Ellen Frank, who is a professor of economics at Emmanuel College in Boston, also a member of the Dollars and Cents Editorial Collective. Welcome to WBAI, Ellen.
Hello, Doug.
Thanks for joining us. Are you there?
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry, but I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
Ah. Should we... Michael's saying everything's okay.
Pump up the volume.
Pump up the volume? Okay, can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay, good. I can hear myself better, too, so everything is better for everyone. First of all, any comments on that end of American hegemony piece?
That's a fascinating piece, really fascinating. I think that, you know, there's a real concern whether the United States is overreaching using its imperial power irresponsibly, and also, you know, spending on guns versus butter. More if you look at the Bush budget, you know, all the big increases are on defense spending, security spending, these kinds of imperial projects, which are going to be very expensive and which mean that the American consumer and American citizen is going to have less in the way of health care and education than people in other countries. It may very well be that capitalists and financiers around the world looking at where to keep their money in a safe place and a safe bet for the future will not see America as the haven it once was.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, here we have this guy coming into office as president on a stolen election really not acting as if he had a narrow mandate, but really imposing a very ambitious agenda domestically and internationally, and sort of a very very America first agenda. And the question of whether it can be financed over the longer term has really barely entered the discourse.
Well, you know, one of the problems is that if there is a decline in American hegemony, as the PIMCO newsletter is claiming. I mean, if this comes about, one possibility is, of course, you know, depression and increased unemployment, and money won't be coming into the United States anymore. We won't be able to live beyond our means and run huge trade deficits and that sort of thing. But another possibility is that we could build alliances with other countries and create international institutions that promote full employment and growth. And given the Bush administration's current policy, international policy and international relationships with the rest of the world, that's not a very likely scenario. And so the impact of a decline in the dollar and a flight from the dollar will, I think, be quite severe on Americans.
Well, this is all a possibility for the future at the moment. But let's talk about something that is already out there, which is Bush's budget proposal. lots of big deficits, lots of shifts in priority and spending. What's your impression of it?
Well, one of the you know, budget proposal by the president is really a statement of the president's policy. You know, what's important, what's going to be funded, where are they going to want to put resources. And as I said before, the Bush administration is proposing big increases in military spending, big increases in security spending, increases in funding for the FBI, increases in intelligence spending. They're proposing modest increases in many other programs, more softer programs like education, health care, that sort of thing. But when you look at the details, you find that the increases for social spending are far less than, first of all, were anticipated in previous budget agreements and previous agreements and bipartisan negotiations between Democrats and Republicans. And furthermore, that many of them are based on proposals for substantial down-the-road cuts. One of the things that's interesting about the Bush's budget proposal is that it shows very clearly the penchant that, for example, Paul Krugman has remarked upon for fuzzy math and sort of squirrely accounting, putting numbers in that make things look better, using a five-year forecast rather than a 10-year forecast so as to front-load spending cuts and backload tax cuts and that sort of thing. So that there's a lot of that in the budget. And just one example of that, last week the Treasury Department put forth a proposal that was really quite shocking in its implications for U.S. tax policy. They proposed a series of accounts that would allow American families to put aside as much as $45,000 a year for a couple with two children in savings that would thereafter be free from taxation. So all interest, dividends, capital gains, anything that accrued in the accounts would be entirely untaxed. This would have a substantial impact on the budget down the road, and yet the Bush administration has not even calculated what that would be in their recent budget proposal.
This was like separate from the budget proposal?
No, this plan was put forth before the budget was proposed, and in fact it was incorporated into the budget proposal, but the way they incorporated it was to show an increase in tax collections as a result of these new accounts, the reasoning being that people would take money out of existing accounts, pay the taxes on the money that they have in the existing accounts, and then move the money into these new accounts. And so in the short run, for the first couple of years, Treasury would see an increase in revenues. It's only 4 or 5 years down the road that we could expect to see really substantial decreases in revenue. How much, I'm not sure. Nobody's really done the math yet. But we're probably talking in the tens of billions of dollars a year.
And while we're at it, we might as well talk about it. This seems to be part of a sort of piece-by-piece overhaul of the tax code to accomplish a long-standing right-wing dream of taxing consumption and letting rich people off the hook.
This is, to me, the most maddening aspect of supply-side or conservative or right-wing economics, whatever you want to call it, is this constant harping on saving and the need for saving. It goes back to Adam Smith. You can find this stuff floating around in the early 1800s, the idea that the growth engine in capitalism is profits, that you should do everything, the government should do everything to promote profits and allow business owners to keep profits, because profits will then be reinvested, and the reinvestment will mean new technology and higher productivity and longer growth and greater growth rates down the line. The problem with that reasoning is that saving is not the same as reinvesting profits in a business. Saving can mean putting money in the stock market. It can mean playing with real estate. It can mean all kinds of highly speculative real estate investment trusts, derivative markets, things like that. And what we tend to see when savings is promoted, when financial investment is promoted over real investment, is not higher growth rates, but more speculative asset price bubbles like we saw in the 1990s.
Yeah, and economists, I think even mainstream ones, are kind of divided upon whether any of these savings incentives actually increase savings. So this is really not even a dead certainty that it would happen.
I don't think there's any evidence at all. And people have done numerous studies to see what impacts savings behavior. And the fact is that when you look at how people behave with regard to savings and how they save, what you find is that the old-fashioned Keynesian view, which is supposedly discredited and archaic, namely that people spend most most of their income, and they save a fairly fixed percentage, and a lot of it depends on the distribution of income in a society, that turns out to be the best predictor of how people save, not what the tax laws are, but simply how much income people have and whether they can afford to save.
Of course, the cynic would say that that's the theory of stimulating investment, savings and investment is just an excuse, a cover for giving big tax cuts to rich people.
Well, I think a cynic would be right. I mean, there's certainly very little evidence that these kinds of tax incentives work. There is an economic model out there that's very popular among rational choice, free enterprise, laissez-faire economists that says that, you know, if there's a dollar to be made somewhere, somebody will figure out how to make it, and so all money will be reinvested and all possible profit opportunities will be pursued and people will rationally use every dollar to their advantage. And that sounds great in theory, but that's not how it works in practice.
How does it work in practice?
Well, how it works in practice is that people are engage in herd-like behavior. Businesses go through investment booms and busts when they get to jump on technology bandwagons. Once the bubble bursts, asset prices decline rapidly. Deflation sets in, unemployment sets, gets higher, the economy stagnates, and it's very difficult to get people to think about undertaking some kind of new investment when they've lost their shirt on the last one.
Which is exactly what we're living through right now.
Exactly.
And let's look a little bit more carefully at the spending side of the Bush proposal. I mean, where is his priorities?
Well, obviously, the priorities are on the military defense intelligence side of things. That's where all the big budget increases are. There are also budget increases for education and for Medicaid and Medicare, but the administration has also made proposals with regard to health spending that would involve fairly substantial cuts down the road. There were actual cuts in the EPA's budget, a lot of cuts in Interior Department programs and agriculture programs that promote conservation and wetland protection and habitat protection. There are cuts in the Department of Labor's budget, cuts for OSHA, cuts for job retraining programs. So we can see that this is an administration that does not see labor or the environmental groups as at all on its side or as a political constituency that needs to be paid off in any sense at all.
And all I can hear the Democrats now complaining about really is the big deficits. First of all, how big are the deficits and how much does that matter?
Well, the deficits that the Bush administration is projecting right now in the budget they sent to Congress would be about a $300 billion deficit in the next couple of years. Then they project that those will decline slightly to around $200 billion in future years. And they've only done a five-year projection. That doesn't include the potential increase in spending if we go to war with Iraq. It doesn't include reforms to the tax system to deal with the alternative minimum tax, which most everybody thinks is necessary, but the Bush administration has never proposed doing anything about it, so I'm not sure that they will. It doesn't include any kind of expenditure for Social Security privatization. It doesn't include any real money for a prescription drug benefit from Medicare. So probably these are fairly optimistic estimates of what the deficit will be. Now, $300 billion is a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money compared to GDP. And I think that the real issue is not the deficits themselves, but the fact that the deficits are really being caused by the tax cuts. You know, without the tax cuts, we wouldn't be seeing deficits like this. And, you know, a case could be made that we'd be better off preserving our tax base so that we could spend money on the programs that we want to have as a country.
But, of course, that's just the opposite of the intention, right? They want to erode the tax base and expand the deficit, so they have an excuse to cut back on spending.
Yeah, and that's the really upsetting thing and the incredibly cynical and confusing thing about the Bush administration's rhetoric and about the whole rhetoric surrounding the deficit in government finances in this country. No sooner does the Bush administration propose this budget to Congress with a huge, that incorporates very significant tax cuts in it, but now the next few days later when the Senate puts forth its own budget with a $390 billion deficit for the fiscal year, the Bush administration balks and says we have to cut spending, we can't afford these deficits, we have to shrink the size of government. The right wing has, since the days of Reagan, been using tax cuts to shrink the size of government and using the resulting deficits as the excuse to shrink the size of government. And the reason they do this, and this suggests something fairly hopeful about American politics is that they don't believe the voters will support cuts in programs for their own sake. So they don't think that they can convince people that we need to cut Medicare just because we need to cut Medicare. They think that they can convince them that we need to cut Medicare only because we need to cut the deficit.
One of the first of all, the you mentioned a couple of times that they're only projecting out 5 years. The conventional budget habit has been to project out 10 years. One suspects they're not projecting out any further because the news would be very, very bad.
I'm sorry, I missed the last part.
Oh, I said the normal budget practice was to project out 10 years, and now the Bush administration is just doing 5 years. One presumes that they're only doing so because it wouldn't be a very pretty picture to look out beyond 5 years.
Well, yeah, one presumes that, and certainly I've heard on the radio over the last couple of days a number of conservative supply-side economists arguing that these 10-year projections are pretty meaningless anyway since they're always wrong. You know, but the virtue of doing a 10-year projection is that it tells you what direction you're headed in under reasonable assumptions, and of course those assumptions can always change and things can always look different a few years down the road. But if you project normal growth rates of, you know, in the range of, you know, 2.5 to 3.5%, you say this is what would happen with the budget. And since most of the tax cuts are backloaded and many of the spending cuts are spending increases are going to be backloaded, they've made things look much better than they probably would be if we continue on this course, which we may not, you know, so it's hard to say.
There's nothing in the budget at all for state and local governments who are having pretty threadbare pockets these days.
No, in fact, I actually think that one of the most troubling parts of the Bush budget proposal is a proposal to increase funding for states for Medicaid. This is very troubling to me because I've actually done quite a bit of research on elder care in this country. And the Bush administration is proposing to convert Medicaid into a block grant program similar to what the Clinton administration did with welfare, so that instead of it being an entitlement, a federal entitlement, which beneficiaries could claim as their legal right, it would be a program that states could play with and fiddle around with and cut benefits or add benefits as they saw fit. The primary likely impact of this down the road will be that states are going to significantly cut Medicaid spending on the elderly. Right now, two-thirds of Medicaid's budget goes to nursing home care and long-term care for the elderly because Medicare does not cover long-term care. And it's fairly clear that the intent of this proposal is to reduce that kind of Medicaid spending and to restrict it to a very, very limited program for the highly indigent, and to stop using it for long-term care, which leaves the question up in the air of who's going to pay for long-term care, because certainly nobody's proposing to increase the Medicare budget to take care of it.
I'm speaking with Ellen Frank, who is a professor of economics at Emmanuel College in Boston, also a member of the editorial collective at Dollars and Cents magazine. What do you see in the way of opposition to the Bush budget proposal? First of all, what's your guess of how Congress is going to receive this, and what are you hearing from the Democratic side of the aisle?
Well, you know, the Democrats, there was a quote I saw in the paper today, I can't remember who it was, who said these guys are just amazing. They don't think about the future at all. And there is kind of an amazement at the cynicism and the short-term political focus of this kind of budgeting and this kind of these kinds of policies. Even the Wall Street Journal has been fairly critical of the Bush proposals because they don't see how it's going to promote growth or stimulate the economy in the short run, and they do see that it's going to really strap the government, and the government does need to do certain things. So I think that I'm not sure how deep the political support for this goes. I mean, there are all these Republican, these ideas that have been banging around for years about consumption taxes and, you know, eliminating taxes on capital income and cutting spending and getting rid of once and for all social welfare spending and privatizing Medicare and all that. But when push comes to shove, I'm not sure how deep the support is, because once you start thinking about how to do it, things get very, very complicated.
And what's your guess of the economic impact of this? I mean, the economy is now not doing too well right now. Is anything in this budget likely to change that?
Well, there is a very strong short-term stimulus in the budget. I mean, it's not huge, but it's significant. I mean, these tax cuts that Bush is proposing that are going to come into effect next year, the increase in the child tax credit and so on, will put a lot of money into the pockets of moderate income households, and that's probably going to have some stimulus effect. You know, Homeland Security spending, defense spending. I mean, these have always been big government, you know, boondoggle programs to provide employment, and they will do that this time. So there will be some stimulus effect of running these big deficits. I think it's unfortunate that we're going to do it this way. It seems to me that there are better ways to do it. If we're going to use government to stimulate the economy, we should be creating jobs that are good jobs, that are long-term jobs, that do socially useful things.
Such as?
Well, such as teaching, such as child care. And one of the things the Bush administration has proposed cutting are child care programs, federal funding for child care programs that were enacted as part of the Transitional Assistance for Needy Family Act that was passed back in the mid-90s. You know, there is a tremendous need for things, for more of that. The Bush administration, about a month ago, I think it was, Cheney gave a speech in which he said that the president and I agree that government doesn't create wealth and government doesn't create jobs. And that's the philosophy of the Bush administration. The government is not going to be an employer or an engine of growth. The government is simply going to be facilitate the private sector making money. And, you know, but the reality is that governments do create jobs and create growth, and we create wealth, and we, you know, educate, governments educate children, and they promote health care, and they do research into, you know, causes of cancer, and they protect habitats, and they conserve land. And these are all things that enhance our nation's wealth.
And, of course, the computer industry would hardly exist if it hadn't been for decades of subsidies out of the Pentagon. So they have a very selective understanding of how wealth is created.
Right, and Al Gore inventing the Internet.
Right, yes. So what's your guess of how this is going to play out politically?
I don't know. I've heard a lot of grumbling from Republicans about the dividend tax cut. Certainly the polls show that the American public is not thrilled with Bush administration's economic policies, and people tend to agree very strongly with the statement that Bush's policies favor the rich. This is something that the Republicans worry about. They worry about getting reelected in 2004, and certainly the latest numbers on productivity suggests that the economy may have done quite a bit worse than a 0.7% growth rate in the last fourth quarter. We may be indeed in another recession.
Maybe it's my memory is playing tricks on me, but you know, this seems even stupider and meaner than the stuff that Reagan used to deliver us. And additionally, we've been here before in a lot of ways, and here we are again. Is my memory playing tricks on me?
I don't know. I mean, that Reagan, everything changed under Reagan. There was a new political order under Reagan, and I guess I feel like we've been living under it for the last 23 years now. The Bush administration has finally got the opportunity to realize some of the things that Republicans have been dreaming about for 23 years.
And it's an amazing ambition for a guy who stole an election.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you for joining us.
Okay,
Frank,
Doug.
Ellen Frank teaches economics at Emmanuel College in Boston and is a member of the Dollars and Cents editorial collective. Dollars and Cents is a magazine on economics, and you can find them on the web at dollarsandcents, all one word, .org. And we'll be back in a moment after this bit of bull market nostalgia from Joey Ramone. That was Joey Ramone's little love song to Maria Bartiromo in a moment of silence, the memory of Joey Ramone and the bull market, of which Maria Bartiromo of CNBC, which Page Six of the New York Post dubbed her the money honey. Well, that's all kind of a memory. Maria Bartiromo is still on CNBC, but the days of watching the bull market on TV are long gone, and so is Joey Ramone, sadly. And we're back. My name is Doug Henwood, the show Behind the News on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the web at WBAI.org. And I can see it's 5:31 and the temperature is 31 degrees outside. I can feel just like a drive time disc jockey here. And we're now joined in the studio by Lenny Brenner, who is a prolific author and the editor of a just-published volume called 51 Documents, subtitled Zionist Collaboration with the Nazis, published by Barricade Books, which is this is the house that Lyle Stewart started after he retired, right?
Right.
Lyle Stewart, of course, published many controversial and often strange books in the in past years, and he would publish things that no one else would touch as well. And I guess this is one of those things that I imagine publishers weren't bidding in a bidding war to publish this collection.
Well, actually, my books do pretty well. Zionism in the Age of the Dictators got a laudatory review from the London Times. So what happened was I actually came to Lyle with the idea of getting him to reprint the book, which is now out of date, you know, out of print, and we decided instead that rather than reprint a book which doesn't get reviewed because it's already been reviewed, that we would put out the documents that I base Zionism in the Age of the Dictators on, the complete text in most cases, you know, plus some couple three large excerpts.
Yeah, and so maybe a lot of listeners will be surprised and shocked to hear this, but there was indeed a lot of collaboration and contact between Zionist leaders and Nazis and Italian fascists and all kinds of unsavory people, right?
For sure.
Yeah, could you give us, first of all, before I get into some details, just the big picture of this?
Well, let's put it this way. Hitler comes to power January 30th, 1933. Okay, so by June of 1933, the Zionist Federation of Germany sends a secret memorandum to the Nazis. All right, it wasn't published until 1963 in German in Israel. In other words, very few people read it. I read it in an English translation with Lucy Davidovich doing the a book by her. Now, I mean, she's certainly one of the most famous Jewish scholars of her day, but very few Jews actually read Jewish history. All right? I mean, in other words, if you break down the Jewish population in the United States, you've got a whole bunch of religious people on one end, let's say 20%, who don't really read much secular history, Jewish history. And then on the other hand, you have a whole lot of people who are of Jewish descent. In other words, they were born into a Jewish family, they're atheists now and whatever, so they don't read Jewish history. So between the two of them, the amount of actual knowledge of not only Zionist history but Jewish history is minimal. But the main thing that the Zionists said then, I mean, let me just read you, you know, a quickie quote so people can get it in context. Now, this is the Zionist Federation to the Nazis, and it's June 21, 1933. Quote, Zionism has no illusions about the difficulty of the Jewish condition, which consists above all in an abnormal occupational pattern and in the fault of an intellectual and moral posture not rooted in one's own tradition. Zionism recognized decades ago that as a result of the assimilationist trend, symptoms of deterioration were bound to appear, which it seeks to overcome by carrying out its challenge to transform Jewish life completely. It is our opinion that an answer to the Jewish question, truly satisfying to the national state, can be brought about only with the collaboration of the Jewish movement that aims at a social and cultural and moral renewal of Jewry. Indeed, that such a national renewal must first create the decisive and social spiritual premises for all solutions. Zionism believes that a rebirth of national life, such as is occurring in German life through the adhesion to Christian and national values, must also take place in the Jewish national group. For the Jew, too, origins, religion, community of faith.
Now, this means that Jewish should undergo the same rebirth Germans are under Nazis.
Yes. This is the Zionists to the Nazis saying, we too, you know.
Now, is this just politic empty flattery, or is this really deeply felt?
Well, let's put it this way. I found only one Zionist who really thought it was like a ginger keen idea that Hitler should come to power. Okay, a guy named Gustav Krojanka, okay, who before Hitler came to power was already saying, hey, you know, we can deal with these guys. But once he came into power, meaning the Zionist Federation of Germany, just simply said, well, you know, we always said we weren't Germans, right? So Hitler comes along and says, we're not Germans. Let's see how we can take advantage of his coming to power. And what they did was they established something called the Haravara, or transfer agreement, with the Nazis, the World Zionist Organization and the German government, okay? Basically speaking, the way it worked was that a German Jew would turn over, let us say, I'm using round numbers, you know, 20,000 Reichmarks to the Nazi government. They, in turn, would then send 20,000, well, let's say 16,000 Reichmarks worth of irrigation pipes or tractors, whatever, to Palestine, where the World Zionist Organization would sell the products, and the Jew would get the 16 minus a little nick also for the World Zionist Organization for actually selling the goods. Okay? Now, to put it in context, from a purely economic point of view, anybody who wanted to leave Germany with their property, didn't matter whether they were Christian or Jewish at that day and age, had to pay a nick going out the door, all right? Let us say, even before Hitler came to power, okay? So let's say the nick would be 40% of your property as you're going out the door gets taken by the government as an exit tax. So this was to the advantage of anybody with relatively small amounts of money. This was the cheapest way of getting your property out of, or your money out of Germany, was through the Haravara. It didn't really pay if you were a huge businessman. You'd rather take a 40% dump and get to New York, okay, where you could set up your business. But, you know, for smaller people, it worked very well. From the Zionist perspective, it was suddenly finding a gold mine. Because you have to put it in context, the Zionist movement at that time lived almost exclusively on contributions from rich Jews, or poor Jews too. But I mean, you know, if you live on the contributions of the poor, your
contributions are rich are a lot larger.
All right. And at the height of the Depression, they announced in a message, which I quote in the book, to their American supporters, "We're broke. No money is coming in. We have debts, you know. I mean, they're running what amounted to a privatized colony in Palestine, because basically the British gave them the right to set up a colony there, but they didn't fund it. They didn't build things for the Zionists, etc. So all of a sudden they're broke, and then all of a sudden Hitler comes to power in one fell swoop at the same time, right? When you realize that Zionism starts out hustling rich Jews in the first place and is a colonial movement in the context of Palestine, it was inevitable that they would try to do a deal with the Nazis. Now, to give you an example of the extent of the deal, the Zionists were selling oranges, which was their major export crop at that time, on Nazi boats to Europe, up to the day the war began in September 1939, all right? They were not only selling German equipment in Palestine, but they were breaking any attempts at a Jewish boycott by selling goods in the Middle East, German goods in the Middle East, and they tried to extend it to Britain, where, you know, they got a little bit there, but, you know, there were too many Jews there, so to speak, to object to that. And they were running into opposition within their own movement from more liberal Zionists who reflected the pressure of the Jewish population. Now, they weren't the World Zionist Organization at that time was run by the Labour, what is now the Labour Party, the guys who just lost the election. The Likud party is the heir and successor to Vladimir Jabotinsky's Zionist revisionist movement. That's his name for his movement. He was trying to revise British policy towards the Zionists in the 20s. That's how he got that name. But at any rate, what their orientation started out pro-British, but then they realized, listen, the British are just using us against the Arabs. They have no intention of giving us a Jewish state. So they began to look to Mussolini for support. And by the end of it, of their campaign, they wound up with a Mussolini establishing a Zionist revisionist naval battalion at Mussolini's Naval Academy. All right? Now, they weren't all fascists. One of their leaders put it very nicely. A fellow by the name of Leopold von Mildenstein, who let me quote him. I mean, he's the guy that tells it. He was interviewed by the French. This is a quote from an article in World Jewry from June 12, 1936. World Jewry was a leading British Zionist publication of the day. The quote: "The French newspaper in Bucharest, The Moment, has published an interview with the Zionist revisionist leader, Dr. von Weizsel. Quote, he personally was a supporter of fascism." All right, yeah, let me scroll back. "The revisionist leader accused the Zionist leaders of socialist sympathies and declared that, although opinions among the revisionists varied, in general they sympathized with fascism, and they were strong opponents of socialism and communism. He personally was a supporter of fascism, and he rejoiced at the victory of fascist Italy in Abyssinia as a triumph of the whites against the black." Now, Abyssinia is what we today call Ethiopia. But here's the opening of their naval squad at Mussolini's Naval Academy in March 1936. The rabbi's benediction. "The order, attention!" A triple chant was ordered by the squadron's commanding officer. "Viva l'Italia! Viva il re! Viva il duce!" resounded, followed by the benediction which Rabbi Aldo Lattes invoked in Italian and in Hebrew, "For God, for the king, and for il duce," followed by a prayer for the Rush Bitar. "Giovinezza" was sung with much enthusiasm by the Betarim, still somewhat awkward with the Italian language. Giovinezza, which is, by the way, a very beautiful Italian song, happened to be the Italian fascist party anthem, all right? And they're singing it, and then later on, the same article, which is from their own magazine, you understand, says, "This year there are 49 cadets. Our human material is extremely intelligent. The majority are university students, and 30 of them belong to the GUF. GUF stands for Giovanetto Universitaria Fascista, the University Fascist Students. Now, what this really means, I mean, to scroll it up to the present in a way, is that the founders of the Israeli army, let's work with their proportions. 30 out of 49 were members of the fascist party, Italian fascist party youth. Okay? So everybody in that period saw what is now the Likud party as then the Zionist revisionists as the Jewish brown shirts, because they literally wore, if you please, brown shirts. I mean, like Hitler. Okay?
You say that the head note to one of the sections here that it was common knowledge in the 30s, this was not controversial, across the political spectrum, that Zionism, revisionism, the Jabotinsky movement was part of the fascist movement.
Well, yeah. See, the funny thing is this. It's a paradox. Jabotinsky was one of the world's most famous linguists. Okay, his Italian was flawless. He had lived in Italy for 3 years. He spoke Italian absolutely like a native. He liked pre-Mussolini Italy. So when Mussolini came to power, his attitude was, I do not follow head buffaloes. I don't, you know, duces. That's not me. I mean, he grew up in the Zionist movement, which is a parliamentary body, right? So he couldn't accept that. But he was so militarized, he had been like Mussolini, he had been a military hero, during World War One with the what they call the Jewish Legion, which was a Zionist group that was set up by the British to help them conquer Palestine from the Turks. And he was so militarized, as I say, he had brown shirts before Hitler. Okay, as he used to say, defending himself when people said, "You have brown shirts like Hitler," he would point out, "I had them before Hitler." Okay. Funny way of thinking, but hey, you know. And what simply happened was by the end of it, he began to recruit people who said, "Look, we're in a funny situation. We have a liberal Duce, but we're fascists." And they openly called themselves fascists, and until finally, in the vicissitudes of politics, by 1940, Jabotinsky's movement got thrown out of Italy. Okay, when Mussolini made his deal with Hitler to be allies in the Spanish Civil War, he realized, I can't be Hitler's real buddy and have Jews in my naval academy. That's out. I mean, Hitler won't tolerate that. So he got rid of these guys, and a wing of them went to, they had a split, and one wing, led by a fellow by the name of Avraham Stern, decided that what really had happened was that, you know, here was Mussolini, who this benefactor of Zionism, who had given them a naval academy, and the Jews, those ingrates, you know, they weren't really friendly to Mussolini after he had done such a noble gesture like that for them. So their goal was to convince Mussolini and Hitler by this time, by 1940, that they really were fascists. So what they did was in 1940, they wrote a document, they hand-delivered it in Beirut to a German diplomat who was in Beirut, because Beirut was run by Vichy France at that time, collaborating with the Nazis. And the document was found after World War II by the Allies in the German embassy archives in Turkey. Okay, and this is it. And now this sounds wild. This sounds like Groucho Marx made this up or somebody. You know, I mean, it sounds too unreal to be true, but it's all true, thoroughly true. The organization called itself the National Military Organization, and it goes on to say, the NMO, which is well acquainted with the goodwill of the German Reich government and its authorities towards Zionist activity inside Germany and towards Zionist emigration plans, is of the opinion that, one, common interest could exist between the establishment of a new order in Europe in conformity with the German concept and the true national aspirations of the Jewish people as they are embodied by the NMO. Cooperation between the new Germany and a renewed Völkisch national Hebraism would be possible, and three, the establishment of the historic Jewish state on a national and totalitarian basis, bound by a treaty with the German Reich, would be in the interest of a maintained and strengthened future German position of power in the Near East. Proceeding from these considerations, the NMO in Palestine, under the condition that the above-mentioned national aspirations of the Israeli Freedom Movement are recognized on the side of the German Reich, offers to actively take part in the war on Germany's side. Now, the NMO is known to most historians as the Stern Gang, named after Avraham Stern. After he died, three guys took over. One of the three guys was a fellow by the name of Yitzhak Shamir. In 1983, Yitzhak Shamir became, is everybody sitting down? Prime Minister of Israel. And he was Prime Minister for seven of the next 9 years. The other two he had to make do with being foreign minister. In other words, this guy, Shamir, who's still alive and is an elder statesman in the Likud party, wanted to go to war on Adolf Hitler's side and told him up front, we're totalitarians and so on and so forth. Okay, so this is the real documentation. All of this has been thoroughly checked out. I was in London when I suddenly read an article back in 1983, when I suddenly read an article that Shamir had said that he had joined the Stern Gang after they had tried to go to war on Hitler's side. And he opposed that, but I joined after they dropped the idea. I happen to have a copy of the text, both in German and in English, of the thing with me. And I walked in on the London Times with a letter exposing him, and they sent an editor down to look at me, you know, I mean, let's put it this way. I'm accusing the guy who had just been nominated to be the Prime Minister of Israel as being a German collaborator. And you got to appreciate that they were looking at it somewhat skeptically. I mean, they literally sent an editor down to look at it. And there it was. I mean, I photocopied it out of a well-known, the German out of a well-known Israeli historian, David Yisraeli's book, and I had it translated, etc. They looked at it, and they said, Mr. Brenner, we're going to run your letter on this guy.
I'm speaking with Lenny Brenner, who has edited this new collection of 51 documents showing Zionist collaboration with the Nazis. And I should say, it's not just a matter of these kinds of practical associations, but there are some ideological affinities as well, right? There is very anti-internationalist, very nationalist. You've got some, so I think it's from Jabotinsky who talks about this almost blood sense of being Jewish. So there are some deep philosophical, ideological
parallels
as well, right?
Doug, are you Jewish?
No.
Okay, all right. Now, let's put it this way. I was born into an Orthodox Jewish family. And practically the first thing that I learned, even before I was thinking about who I was going to marry, was that I had to marry a Jewish girl, all right? In other words, a very heavy self-segregation of Orthodox Jewry. I mean, you marry Jews, okay? And that became even accelerated. I mean, that was true in ancient times. It became even accelerated in medieval times and went into modern times with this. You marry Jews. Jews marry Jews. Okay. But appreciate that Zionism is a reflection of the sudden expansion of capitalism from Western Europe into Central and Eastern Europe, where everybody, every nationality, every religion had to relate to the new economy and the new ideologies that were coming up. As part of that kit of the rise of capitalism, you had the rise of social Darwinism and what we call racism. Okay, so the result is that what you get is all of a sudden Zionists are finding that that religious restriction on intermarriage was like a lucky, like a shell around the nut, which was preserving racial purity, which was the name of the game all over Europe in that day. I mean, the intelligentsia of that day was almost all of the capitalist class. I mean, very few poor people, people of poor families went to school, etc. So that kind of racism was all over the place. And strangely enough, one of the most bizarre forms of that adaptation of racism into Zionist terms was Albert Einstein, who was certainly the most famous Zionist of his day.
And the smartest man who ever lived. Right?
And what?
Like the smartest man who ever
lived. Well, right? You'll listen to this, you'll ask a question about that, all right? This is from Einstein, Assimilation and Nationalism in 1921. He wrote this. Nations with different racial differences appear to have instincts which work against their fusion. The assimilation of the Jews into the European nations among whom they lived, in language, in custom, and to some extent even in the forms of religious organization, could not eradicate the feeling of a lack of kinship between them and those among whom they lived. In the last resort, this instinctive feeling of lack of kinship is referable to the law of the conservation of energy. For this reason, it cannot be eradicated by any amount of well-meaning pressure. Now, your listeners today have gotten a bonus, okay? They have just discovered that each and every one of them is smarter than Albert Einstein, all right? Because there's no law of conservation of energy that prevents ethnic groups from jumping into bed together.
All right, we're just about out of time, but let's just conclude on this note. What does this mean for today?
Well, it means that Zionism is really a racist form of movement that concretely fixates itself on, quote, Israel, which is inside a country called Palestine, and which they, as Jews, must have special privileges. Okay? Now, I mean, obviously, the Nazis are not around for them to ally themselves with anymore. They have to make do with George Bush and so on. But They are absolute opponents of equality before the law, what we call civil rights in the United States for Palestinians, and for that matter, I mean, this is, you know, something for, let's say, another program or something like that, or another time. They discriminate against all Jewish religious sects that aren't part of the Orthodox Jewish religion. A Reform Jewish rabbi who can perform a marriage in New York cannot perform a legal marriage in Israel. So it's become like the last refuge, last official state that I know of. There may be some. They're similar, let's say, to the Islamic states to declare a state religion. But it also has this very Jewish blood thing. Like, I am eligible to be an Israeli citizen, you know, just coming off the boat, off the airplane, because I was born of a Jewish mother. All right? Now, that's a racist definition of citizenship. But you want to take a long view. Any movement that could think in terms of allying itself to the Nazis not only is not good to the Jews, it sounds like it's going to be bad news to the Arabs, and is certainly not any friend. You know, they talk about Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, but, you know, you don't talk about only Christian democracy in the Middle West or something. It doesn't have that same good sound, you know, and that's really what they're pushing over there, is a subtle combination of racism and religious bigotry.
All right, we have to dip there. Thank you for joining us, Lenny Brenner, who is the editor of 51 Documents, documenting Zionist collaboration with the Nazis, just published by Barricade Books. That's it for me, and let's go out on an internationalist note. Next week, I think I'll be here for a two-hour special. If another world is possible, what might that world look like? I got Naomi Klein and Walden Bella lined up, and other guests as well. So stay tuned for the news, and let's go out with a little internationalism from Billy Bragg.
Stand up, all victims of oppression, for the tyrants be your might. Don't cling so hard to your possessions, for you have nothing, you have no right.